And welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fosbero. This week's guest is best known for being one of the stars on Channel 4's gruelling hit shows SAS Who Dares Wins. Matthew Ollie Ollerton is a former UK Special Forces operative who's been involved in counter-terrorism missions, humanitarian efforts, hostage rescues, you name it, he's done it. He spent 6 years as a combat frogman in the Special Boat Service during that time. As well as being a TV personality, Ollie has just released a book using his elite training and personal experiences to help us cope with some of the difficulties and challenges that we may face in life. And he shares what he's learned through his company Breakpoint. Ollie, I know you're packing for Australia, so thanks so much for squeezing us in. What are you up to down under?
We're actually going back to, and I say going back because we're actually out in New Zealand starting filming SAS Who Dares Wins for Australian TV, a celebrity version for Australian TV Channel 7. So we got that cut short because of lockdown, and we're going back to Australia this time, not New Zealand, to start filming again.
Wow, the programme is really addictive. What's it like for you to film?
It's tough, and I don't mind saying that because, as you can see, I mean, it's not the usual type of thing you'd imagine where it's, you know, we didn't get that right, it's a cut. Any of that, you know, it's a fly on the wall type affair. And we're working 18-hour days. I mean, to be quite honest, we always say it. I know we absolutely rinse the contestants or candidates, but we get less sleep than they do. That's because, like I say, you know, you have to change. You have to be dynamic. You have to sort of work with what you're faced with. And you don't know that until the whole event plays out.
Are contestants absolutely shocked by what you put them through? Because I know, you know, we've all seen the programme on TV, but when they're actually there in person for real and they're facing the sorts of things that you put them through, is there a shock element to it?
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't ever think it's any specific event. I mean, some of the stuff is really, you know, there's a lot of people that are scared of heights. There's a lot of people they're extremely uncomfortable doing. But when you look at the bigger picture, I think, you know, because everyone sits there. I know there's a lot of people out there that sit there in their armchairs, you know, the red wine warriors and say, I could smash that. I could do that. But the thing is, when you're in that environment, when your luxuries are taken away, when you've got sleep deprivation, when you've got hunger, when you've got the total anxiety of not being in control and knowing anything could happen, that creates a whole different beast in between your ears. And really, it's the state of mind we put them into, which is a lot more scarier than any one single event we do.
And what are the rewards for you at the end of the filming process? What do you like best?
I think the rewards for me are not directly where I'm at within the show. I think for me, it's from the outside looking in when it actually airs on TV. Obviously, we're privy to all the messages and stuff on Instagram. And just the fact it inspires so many people, they absolutely go through a very transformational process, and they're very different people when they leave in a very short space of time, which really does give you an insight as to what happens to a Special Forces soldier. You know, they go through a massive transformation, and when we do it for real, we go through a 6-month process, so it's a lot more intense, a lot longer. But it just really shows that to break these people down and then rebuild them, and they come out the other end with life-changing differences that are extremely positive. So that is definitely a plus. The inspiring messages we get, you know, you've changed my life. I've started being more positive. I've started engaging in exercise, you know, all that kind of stuff. That is music to my ears.
Now, in real life, of course, you not only got through the infamously tough selection process, which you mentioned there is a 6-month process, but with a busted ankle, what was that like?
Yeah, to be honest as well, Helen, without going into too much detail, that was the second time around. I did basically 2 Special Forces selections near enough back to back, well, a 6-month gap between the two. First time round, I was like 2 days to the end. I got in a bit of an altercation with a Welsh farmer.
As you do. Were you arguing over sheep or something?
There was no arguments. He was just extremely drunk and he fell over. He was almost like the resistance. He was giving us a lift when he shouldn't have been giving us a lift. And we shouldn't have been in any kind of vehicles or having any contact. So we were being a bit naughty as well. But he fell over and busted his head, found himself in hospital and told the police that he had been beaten up by the SAS. And, 2 days to the end, after 6 months, I was 1 of 5 and we all got returned to unit. And that was probably the lowest point of my life. I then went back and had to make some real big decisions about doing it all again. The raging fire of a passion to achieve what I wanted to achieve was no longer, but there was still some embers in that fire. I managed to recreate back into the burning glow of passion to get back on selection. But when I went the second time, very early on in the phase, my ankle did a 90 degree on a march with a very heavy pack on. I felt all the tendons snapping and then it looked like it was doom and gloom. But they wanted to take me off. They wanted to say, look, if we give you a medical withdrawal, you can come back and do another one. But if I failed one of the marches, I would never come back in. I'd never be allowed. You're only allowed two attempts. I just said, no. I knew in my head it was now or never. So although they were like, you're crazy, you're going to fail, I just managed to take a load of brufen and I pretty much floated the rest of the course.
I mean, it has a reputation, doesn't it, for being the hardest military training in the world. And I think you've been quoted as saying it's all about mindset, isn't it?
I mean, even the physical stuff is about mindset. Your mind will give up way before your body. And that's, you know, the messages that are going on in your head. I think the big thing about Special Forces selection and something we do on the show as well, and it's a real shock when it happens to you for the first time. You imagine as a young child, the first time you come home with that drawing for your fridge and your mummy goes, oh, this is absolutely brilliant. We're going to put that there to show the world how brilliant you are. And then that sets off your addiction to external validation for everything you do. And we thrive off that as humans, you know, the things we wear, the things we do, it's all about the ego. It's all about getting attention for that. When you do Special Forces selection, there's no one there telling you or giving you a pat on the back. And that is a really hard pill to swallow. You might like be at the front of the pack, smash, and you're looking around for that validation, but there's no one there saying that was really good. You did really well there. And that's a real shock. And then before you know it, the seed of doubt starts eating away. And so many people fail themselves. You imagine in war, you go through something really tough. There's no one there clapping on the other side saying that was a really good attack. You know,
it's mind sort of game that they're playing with you, completely intentional.
Yeah, 100%, because it really boils down to self-motivation. When you're in the Special Forces, when you're in a war zone, when you're behind enemy lines or whatever it is, you don't get to decide when it's over. So you really need that strong self-discipline and self-motivation just to keep on going till as long as it takes and not require that validation. Not requiring validation is part of that, you know, taking that away so you're not always looking for that kudos and that validation. It's a mind game. And everything with Special Forces selection, once you get the physical out of the way, which is greatly a mental process as well, once you get that out of the way, though, it's all psychological.
And when you're in the Special Forces, what missions do you look back on that you can tell us a little bit about? I'm basically trying to get a flavour of the sort of work you did.
The one that stands out for me, and listen, Helen, to be quite honest, I mean, I was in, when I look back now, they were pretty quiet years. And it's a lot of the reason why I left the Special Forces, because I had a very dangerous appetite to wanting to be chasing death everywhere. It was crazy. But there were still jobs on, but there wasn't enough. But I can always remember my first job, and it was really in my brain that I was Special Forces. And first, I qualified as a Special Forces operator, joined my team in the Special Boat Service down at Poole, and we were given pagers. I don't know if people know what they are anymore, but basically...
I'm old enough to remember. It was a little thing that attached to you, wasn't it? And it gave you a little message on it.
Gave you a little message and a beep and a buzz. You'd have your pager, and I can remember I came out of camp and it was like I was part of the Special Forces now, and it was all like, yeah, so what's this all about kind of thing? And then, you know, on a Friday, the pager went off, and there used to be certain codes on the pager which said whether it was a drill or not or whatever it was, but the code came up which said, this is not a drill. So you had about 30 minutes to get back to camp, where we went straight into a briefing. Before we knew it, we were on helicopters going up to a forward operating base in the UK. And pretty shortly after that, we went out in the dark of night, all in black, little submachine guns on helicopters, speedboats, the whole lot, and attacked a ship and took it down, basically. And it was one of the most... I just had a big smile on my, although it was extremely hazardous and dangerous, it was just one of the biggest smiles I had underneath my balaclava ever. It was just amazing. And then in the morning when we'd hit the ship, and then when it came to extraction, the sun was just coming up on the horizon. As we were lifting the boat, a big Chinook, which is the double propped helicopter, came in, lifted the boat out of the water and just took us off into the sunset. Later that evening, I was supping beers down in Bournemouth, just thinking, this is crazy. And I loved it.
What did you mean when you said you had an appetite for chasing death?
Yeah, listen.
You slipped that one in, Ollie.
Yeah, no. When I look back now, it's crazy. But most of my life, and only up until about 8 years ago, I still had that appetite. And I really focused back, and I'm probably jumping ahead of the question here, but hindsight is a wonderful thing, but it never won any wars. But the thing is, it helps you reflect and it helps you to connect the dots and put the pieces together. But I had a traumatic experience at 10 years old where I nearly got killed, ripped apart by a chimpanzee at the circus, believe it or not.
Oh my goodness, what happened?
Well, that's another story in itself. But basically, the circus had set up in town. I think it was Chipperfield Circus. So we ended up running down there so excited. And we ended up having a look around. And I'd split up from my brother and his mate, found myself in this open sort of enclosure. I mean, this is back in the 1980s. I mean, there was no health and safety. And I found myself in this sort of open expanse with just me and this baby chimp. And it was just surreal. You know, I idolized Tarzan and Cheetah. This was like a little piece of Hollywood. Sat in front of me. I was only 10 years old. And I found myself over this chimp, compelled to go and say hello to it. And it started feeding me bits off the floor. And I was thinking, I'm not eating that. It's disgusting. So I started just going through the motions. I didn't want to offend the chimp. And then mummy chimp, which was in the shadows behind, which I didn't see at that time, obviously saw me as a threat. And then came charging at me at Mach 10. It was about 50 kilograms worth of chimp. I didn't weigh it, but it was big. Next thing, this thing pounced through the air, landed on top of me and just started ripping me to bits. Yes. And, you know, there was blood and stuff flying around. And at that point, I knew I was going to die unless I actually did something. And it wasn't a case I was sat there going, I think it's time I did something. You know, it's like it was instinct. I had to do something. I knew my survival instinct kicked in. I had to do something. So I retaliated. But by retaliating, I knew that I would up the ante. I took the fight to the chimp. As a 10-year-old, that's pretty ballsy. I don't mind saying so myself. And I managed to dislodge the chimp off my chest. It gave me a couple of inches and I managed to get my knee up to my chest and kick it off me. And then I scurried back and it came on its final attack for me and it was caught by a chain.
Oh my goodness.
I stood there dripping with blood. Chimp was still going crazy and half my arm was sort of fell apart. But it was that moment. And really, the place I'm sat in now is really the reason for that chimp, believe it or not, because that was very much what I refer to now as my first break point. It was the moment I decided to step into the short-term discomfort that was retaliating for any chance of long-term gain. And that long-term gain was living. And that breakpoint moment, you know, it's not all about being attacked by a chimp or having something that hectic. You know, we all go through breakpoints in our life on a daily basis. When it comes to any kind of growth, any kind of development, any kind of change in our repeat habit loops that we're stuck in, it's about facing that short-term discomfort, knowing that the long-term gain is on the other side of that and really embracing that moment, because we're all victims of avoiding stress, looking for our comfort zones, and there is no growth or comfort really in the comfort zone. When I look back 10 years old, you know, I look at this place, I sat here, this is the Breakpoint Academy now, and it really stems back all the way to when I was 10 years old and being attacked by a chimp.
And how did that attack by the chimp change your mental attitude to things? I mean, in a way, Ollie, did it make you feel that you were invincible, that you were 10 years old and you'd managed to survive what sounds a really, really nasty, brutal attack?
Yeah, and that takes me on to the question, the original question which you asked. That changed the course of my life. They do say childhood trauma is one of the worst types of trauma. I truly believe that because we are sponges for information and experience at a young age, and it really shapes our future. So from that moment, I was just chasing danger everywhere I could. You know, I was pushing my limits. I was void of consequence, void of emotion, and I didn't really care about anything about I just wanted to cause havoc everywhere. And after that, I just marginally skimmed a custodial sentence as a kid. I got into a lot of trouble with the police, caused a lot of grief to my parents. And it was just utter mayhem. It really was utter mayhem. I then went into the military, which was a natural evolution for me, almost like the only place I could have gone. Not because it was the only option, but for me, it just met everything. It just ticked every box I could ever expect, or my perception of it did. So that's when I joined the military. And then I joined the military, passed as a Royal Marine Commando, very proud moment. Got disillusioned and went to Desert Storm, Iraq, went to Northern Ireland. And I love that. I love being in war. And that sounds crazy to me now, but I wanted to be in war every day because I felt at home there and I felt at comfort in chaos. I now call it peace in war. being home was more stressful than being in a war zone. You know, for me, it was like being in a war zone was absolute, you know, it's black and white. There's people wanting to kill you and you were going to do everything to prevent that from happening and meet them with the same kind of aggression. And that for me was pure comfort at that stage of my life.
The difficulty is, though, that chaos gets addictive, doesn't it? And I say that as somebody who worked at Sky News with war cameramen and some war cameramen who ended up suffering post-traumatic stress and things like that, who at the time they would come home and their life would spin out of control at home and they couldn't wait to get back to the front line. It gave them, I don't know, perhaps an addiction to that kind of chaos. I mean, were you drawn back to war zones in that kind of way, Ollie?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example because they feel that same draw to a war zone, to that danger. It was addictive. And I think as a special forces soldier as well, I know that you don't get into flow until you're in chaos. When things start going wrong, when everything starts going noisy, when the whole world around you is falling apart, that's really when a special forces soldier starts to show his true skill. What I was addicted to, I was addicted to that high-end adrenaline when everything is going so fast and you really have to sort of triage every moment to understand where the threat is, what you have to deal with. And I just felt it flowing that and I just chased that like an adrenaline buzz. Even when I left the special forces, I was drawn back to that. Although I said I'd never go back to a war zone, pretty soon I found myself back in a war zone.
And how did it affect you on a personal front? Because in your book, Battle Ready, you had to dig deep at times, didn't you? I mean, it didn't have necessarily a positive effect on you as a person.
No, it was only up until 2015 I made my changes. Up until that point, my life was absolute mayhem and destruction. I left the special forces in 2000. And really, once that everyday sort of framework and scaffolding had fallen away, my camaraderie, my network of support, my mates had gone. There was a massive void, a really big void. I mean, a lot of people can relate to that now with what's going on with furlough and the lockdown. So I spent 10 years, at least 10 years, just bouncing all over the world, trying to find this external fix that was going to make me happy. I mean, I didn't find it in the special forces. That was the bizarre thing. In a job that was supposed to really tick all the boxes, and you'd expect it would make anyone that has that dream of being a special forces soldier, it would completely satisfy everything you could want in life. I didn't find my purpose. I didn't feel fulfilled. But after I left, from the outside looking in, and this is really what a lot of, especially men do, is from the outside looking in, I was happy. I was a party guy. I was fun. And if anyone asked me ever, it was, yeah, I'm doing great, you know, and always focusing on the good, which isn't a bad thing. But behind the smile, which was usually due to intoxication with alcohol, there was a whole different story going on and it wasn't a good one. But that's what we do, you know, again, reflection and hindsight. I really see so many people doing that these days, and this is really amplified by social media, that so many people are so invested in creating the perception of someone they're not. They put so much time, energy, and emotion into this person they want everyone else to think they are, and behind the true emotions, they become a byproduct. And it's really sad to see. I mean, I know everyone does it to a certain degree, but there's so many people that would compromise everything about themselves just to make sure that the outside world thinks that they've got the perfect life, and you end up compromising yourself.
In the military, though, Ollie, I mean, you're expected to be a hard man. You know, you're trained as a sort of war machine, if you like, to be in the most dangerous situations in the world. Do you think the military allows you to hide from your own emotions and feelings and makes you almost devoid of that?
I'd totally agree that, I mean, especially in my day, listen, I can't speak for what changes might have happened. I know certainly that stigma, they're trying to change that. But certainly in my day, you couldn't show any emotion because that was weakness. Anytime you did show emotion, you were just ridiculed, and then probably you end up drinking a load of beer, getting absolutely drunk, doing stupid things, and then moving on to the next thing. And there was just no decompression. There was no decompression from anything. And to be quite honest, I mean, I look back and you know, it almost sounds like I'm blaming the military for that. And I don't blame the military for that, because I truly believe until the student's ready, the teacher can't do his work anyway. And I think if I'd have left, right, and someone had said to me, right, Ollie, you have got to go away to a camp for 2 weeks where we're going to sort of go through all some cognitive therapy and all this, I'd have said, no, I'm not. I would have definitely refused because I wasn't ready for it. And I also think as well, with a lot of trauma, I mean, I don't blame the military because I joined messed up from the chimp attack and everything else that happened in my life. I joined messed up. But it doesn't come out until a lot later. It's not like you have a traumatic event and then the next day you're like, oh, I need some therapy. It doesn't happen like that. We're wired to lock away that intimate trauma immediately. That's a self-protection system that we have. But the thing is, at some point, that's going to come out. You can't hide it. And I've only just learned that. I only just dealt with the chimp last year.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, and my goodness. That's amazing.
That was life-changing again for me. I mean, I come a long way, but I only really got to grips with it last year.
Before we find out how you turned your life around and we talk about visualizing and the spiritual psychologist that you saw and all the fascinating things that have created the sort of person you are now, what was your proudest moment, do you think, in Special Forces? Is there any mission that stands out for thinking, gosh, that was fantastic? I'm thinking perhaps more on the humanitarian side.
To be quite honest, the level of camaraderie, the teamwork, and the almost seamless working with a team that's so highly trained was just unreal. I've never had that experience. I took it for granted when I was in. But honestly, when you're with a highly trained team like that and you work together so closely and so bonded, it's almost like telepathy. And I really mean that. It's almost like it flows in such a harmonic way. It's so hard to explain, but I'll never forget those moments. But the amount of trauma that I caused my mum and how she stuck by me. I mean, my father left when I was 13 and my mum's life was falling apart. And although her life was falling apart financially and emotionally, she still had the strength. She put everything aside just to concentrate and focus on me. She pulled me up from the darkness and really set me on the path to where I am today. And I'll never forget her for that. You know, it was amazing. So for my mum, A, to be at my Royal Marines pass out was just the best moment of my life. For my mum to get that phone call from me saying, I've passed Special Forces selection was just amazing. You know, I was her investment. I gave her nothing.
Is your mum still around, Ollie? Do you still have mum?
Yeah, she was actually here for the first time here at the weekend. Was it the weekend? I'm losing tracks. Every day is just another day.
Oh, she must feel so proud of what you're doing now.
No, she is. You know, she's always been my greatest supporter. You know, I'm massively creative. I come up with some crazy ideas. The team here at Breakpoint are like that. Can you please not have any ideas for the next 6 months? But my mum's always embraced them, you know, where people have sort of said, nah, that won't work. When I started this company, when I came back, I had nothing. And, you know, I wanted to start my company Breakpoint. We didn't even have a TV show at that point. I was telling people, even in my family, and they were saying, no, you don't want to do that. You want to go back. You kind of guys go out to war zones. You want to go back and do that. That's the perfect suit for you. And I was like, no. And she was the only one that really, really supported what I wanted to do. And now I'm sat here and that's very satisfying. And she came up here, looked around the offices and the Breakpoint Academy. And she's like, you must be proud. That's great to see her so happy.
Ollie, you said that your lowest point came in 2007 when you left the military. So how did you cope with that and turn your life around? And how you turned your life around is, I'm imagining, a big question, really, because it's a complicated answer, probably.
In between all the sort of big wins I've had and all the success, I've had more years of low points and trauma than I have the sort of successes and wins. So really, I mean, I left it in 2000. I then went and bounced all over the world. I spent 6-7 years in Iraq as a contractor, a military contractor, which was absolutely horrendous. I say horrendous because we were in a war zone there for 6 years and you should never be in a war zone for that long. And we were getting...
You lived in horrendous conditions there too, didn't you?
We had nice villas, but we're in the red zone, right in the thick of it. We were being attacked on a regular basis. We had to totally encase the villas in steel so that when the bullets were going down, we had to run around the house, shutting all the windows and putting steel across the doors and everything. And that was just mentally, that environment, it was like self-imprisonment for 6 years. And then we had a few really close attacks as well. So when I say it was horrendous, I mean, we lived quite well out there considering, but we had no support elements. I didn't think I was going to come back from Iraq at all. And I had to get out of there in 2007 because things were not going well. We lost a few locals that worked for us, were kidnapped. I heard them on the phone once being killed. I could hear that down the telephone. We lost a couple of local lads that we used to serve with. So I had to get out of there because my mental health was deteriorating. I was using alcohol a lot. And also I was more addicted to Valium. It was a lethal combination. came back from there, and then I sort of managed to stabilize things. And I was like, I thought, I'm never going back to a war zone, never going back, and managed to get into some property development and stuff. And I thought, but I was just so bored. And next thing, I ended up hearing about an organization in Thailand that were rescuing kids from child prostitution and slavery. The figures just were crazy. 1.6 million kids a year sold into sex slavery and prostitution. And these kids are being sold by their parents and their grandparents. And I wanted to do something to help change the destiny of these kids' lives. So I went over to Thailand, and it was self-funded. And I led operations into rescue these kids from Thailand. And it was amazing. I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt fulfilled, complete, totally humbled for the experience I was having to see these kids, you know, that were going to be sold into prostitution and slavery, to see them being taken away, you know, rescuing these kids and then putting them through a process where they'd go to an orphanage, and then they'd start, and they'd, you know, seeing the kids at one stage in the camps where we basically rescued them. And then the next thing, to see them walk down the street with their school bags and their little school uniform on. I mean, that memory I'll never forget. That was the most fulfilling thing I've ever done in my life. Forget the special forces. That was it. And I thought, this was me. I was going to do that for the rest of my life. But a political situation kicked off. It was all over the media what we'd done, because we'd done so much work, and it caused a bit of an international incident with the United States and Thailand. Thailand denied all knowledge of anything like that going on in their country. And then there was a manhunt for us. We had to escape out of Thailand across the Burmese border. And I came back living in Australia at that time. I was broken, because I'd invested all the money I had, even withdrawn my pension to support going over there, my military pension, which paid for that operation. The charity had to close. Everything fell apart, and I fell apart. And that was my lowest moment. At one point, I was, not that there's any disrespect to anyone, but I was working in a laundrette. I was just at the lowest point. I was just trying to make ends meet, and I just had nothing. Picking myself up from that was why I wrote my book.
And so how do you do it, Ollie? I mean, for people listening, I'm going to go and actually get your book and read it. But for people listening to this podcast, where do you start to pick yourself up? And what are the key things that have really, really helped you turn it all around and be in a position to do what you're doing now?
It's a long road, because it requires self-discipline and process. And it requires you to really disengage what's going on in your head and follow your heart. Unfortunately for us, we are so programmed that we follow the head before we even think about the heart and the internal messaging that's going on up there and everything else. And it's basically lying to us. Once we can disengage from the emotion, disengage from the messages that are going on in our head, and put a process into play that takes us out of the repeat habit loops of negative habits, then we can start to see a path forward. And without going into this, because it's a very complex topic and it's something I cover greatly in my book, I didn't really get to grips with what I needed to do until I understood how we work as humans, how we're wired, what goes on in our head. And when I look back, you know, I've done a lot of research, and really just from experience, I understand that we are wired negatively. That's just the way we're wired. That comes down to human evolution. Everyone can relate to that. Every time you're looking to make any kind of changes, we always look for everything that could go wrong. Because that really, where evolution is concerned, that is the one thing that's kept us alive.
But it's the protection side, isn't it? That's yeah. How we protect ourselves, I suppose.
That's 100% it. Technology is going well in advance of us, but we're still working off that primal sort of wiring. You know, cavemen never used to come out of their caves and go, oh, today I'm going to have some fantastic opportunities. They came out going, shit, where's that saber-toothed tiger? Or where's, you know, looking for everything that was going to kill them. So they lived in a state of fear. And we're still living off that primal imprint.
Without oversimplifying it, is that where visualization comes in? Because I know that's something that you're very into, isn't it? Do we visualize a more positive outcome?
Thing is, there's a lot of people, right, they talk about mental health at the moment, right? I find that you can't get mental health until you start investing in mental wealth. Mental wealth for me is when you start to really give yourself something. So for me, that was taking away the alcohol, or extremely minimizing the amount you had, taking anything that is going to cloud the raw nerve of where you need to go. And that for me was removing all those external factors. And it was creating a pathway to a vision of where I wanted to be and not where I was. whether you call it a vision, a goal, whatever it is, it's the same thing. But you've got to visualize that you've been there. You've got to visualize how it feels emotionally and engage all the senses, your hearing, your touch, your smell, and actually just live that moment. I mean, I meditate every day, and this is what I did. You know, I put myself through a process of meditation, of writing down my goals, positive affirmations, and I didn't focus. And that's what a lot of people do. A lot of people that know they've got an issue because of a traumatic experience, they're forever talking about the traumatic experience. And another thing is they always try to fight for the person they were before the traumatic experience. If you try and do that, you're never going to get to that person again because you're different. So the more you fight for what you were, the more frustration, the more heartache, the more mental stress you're going to cause. So it's really about looking forward, casting a stone to where you want to be, create a vision, put a path and a process into play, and follow the process and disengage your mind. Because your mind is a devious beast and it will tell you things that just aren't true. It will keep you in that repeat habit loop. As far as evolution is concerned, we want to keep doing the same thing we did yesterday and the day before and the day before. Because as far as evolution is concerned, it's kept us alive until today. It doesn't care if you're happy or sad, whether it's a good situation or a bad situation. It wants to keep us in that repeat habit loop. So when it comes to process, when it comes to visualization, when it comes to goals, that takes you out of that repeat habit loop. And then you step into the short-term discomfort for long-term gain. And that is breakpoint.
So that takes you out of that procrastination and hesitation phase that presumably feeds all the self-doubt and the negative feelings.
100%. And you've got to really, you know, initially it is clunky. And that's why the book I've written, Battle Ready, I mean, that's my second book. The first one was called Breakpoint, which really sort of defines who I am. And I consider them both self-help books because I share my knowledge of things that happened to me and how people can use that information to change their lives. But I absolutely put that process into play. And I talk about that process in Battle Ready, my new book. 2015, I came back to the UK and I was broken. But I had one dream, a dream to create Breakpoint. The mission statement is to create a globally identified brand recognized for the positive growth and development of others. Okay, that was my dream and that was it. I was doing that. I didn't care about anything else. I had to avoid getting into another job, especially in the sort of security field, which pays well, because that would have just distracted me from where I wanted to be. And I sat there, put myself into self-isolation for 2 months in 2015. But I knew that I had to put myself into isolation because I couldn't have any external distractions from where I needed to be. And I did all these things. I got up in the morning and I meditated. I put a plan into play. I wrote down my goals. I broke the goal down into measurable chunks and made sure I met those milestones. And it was like I was looking at myself and that 1,000-person audience we've all got following us around, which really isn't there, was looking at me going, you're an idiot. Everyone's laughing at you. There was no one there but me, and it's all in your head. But you've got to try and just switch that off, remain non-judgmental for a period of time. And I tell you now, 2 months it took me, and I didn't even recognize the person I was at the start of that.
And how is life now, Ollie?
Life is just amazing. You know, it's taken me flipping 49 years to get here. But now it's all been worth it. And I've got no regrets. But listen, I mean, I'm very thankful for the show. It's brought my business a massive amount of exposure. But that is really the meaning behind the TV show for me. Apart from the fact it does inspire people and everything else, for me, it helps bring exposure to my company where I can do exactly that. I'm at the coalface of helping people.
And it must feel very satisfying when you do help people and you perhaps read their letters or their messages after they've come to Breakpoint and you've seen how you've been a small part in helping others change their life and get them out of their chaos.
And that for me is just like the biggest reward I could ever want. The turning point for me, I think it's really important to state as well. I mean, I joined the military and it was low paid and I'm high maintenance when it comes to money. I like my clothes. I like the good stuff in life.
You like your new beast that you've been posting on socials too, your lovely motorbike.
I bought that for my girlfriend. That was the excuse anyway to buy another
one.
She hasn't even passed the test. But I do love those things. So, I mean, I've never really had, you know, in the military, you don't get paid a lot of money. And that was a struggle for me, a big struggle. When I came out, everything was about chasing the money. And that's what took me to Iraq because there was big pay there. But I never actually started to feel the benefit of any kind of balance in financially until I stopped chasing the money. And it's just how you frame things. You know, my business is created. It's not about the money at all. I'm not living a lavish lifestyle as such. You know, I managed to get myself a nice motorbike and stuff. But
you just said yourself a nice motorbike.
Well, that's the one. I bought one as well.
Okay. I'll let you off.
But the thing is, my whole focus is about helping others. The financial side and the benefits are a byproduct of that. Once I started framing things that way, I stopped being a slave to the money. That changed my life dramatically.
Do you know, Ollie, it's fantastic to talk to you today. I mean, safe travels in Australia. We can't wait to have you back on our screens soon. I'm going to order a copy of Battle Ready. Keep helping others because it's really fantastic what you're doing. And there are a few people gone through in life what you've gone through in Special Forces and with the chimp attack and in your childhood that are in that position to sort of find their way out and help other people navigate their lives. Fantastic work. Keep it going.
Thank you. And I'd just like to say as well, I mean, it's hard for a lot of people relating sometimes because they are in a really bad place, but it doesn't matter where you are, you can improve that situation. You can get out of it. So don't ever think that you're cursed. You can change your current circumstances regardless.
Fantastic. Well, that was Ollie Ollerton, star of Channel 4's SAS Who Dare Wins and a former Special Forces operative whose extraordinary life experiences are out there to help all of us. Thanks very much for listening to this week's Convex Conversation. It's been a pleasure, as always. Please do share our podcast with friends and family. We're at convex.podbean.com or on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. I'll be back next week. I'll see you soon.